and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 4th, 2019, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and we've got a great show for you today. I chat with a brilliant woman all the way from across the globe, but before we get into that, I want to thank my top supporters, give you guys a shout out. If you're interested in pledging your support for the show, you can go to patreon.com/talknerdy, just like these guys did. So they include Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, love that, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. There's also a bunch of other ways to support the show. I've told you about them before. So just really quickly, you can find them all if you go to carasantamaria.com. That's easy, right? Okay, let's get into the meat. Guys, this week, oh, I'm so thrilled. I've been trying to connect with Sonia Pemberton for so long, and we're finally able to get this this interview on the books and get it recorded. So she's the creative director of Gene Pool Productions. This is her production company where she works as an award-winning documentary film producer. She has won an Emmy. She has won the Eureka Award for science journalism 5 times, more than anyone else. And she makes beautiful, brilliant science documentaries. And you may have already seen some of them. If not, hopefully this interview will inspire you to check out Vitamania, Jabbed, Uranium, what else? Lawless. There's so many others. Some of them have different names in different markets. Tales of the Unexpected, The Secret Life of Breasts. I don't even think we get into that on the show, but come on. Amazing. Immortal, Catching Cancer. So many fascinating documentaries that are just really jam-packed with evidence. They're fact-based. They're beautifully shot. And they open your eyes up to science in a way that, you know, not many people and not much content can actually do. So I can't say enough things about her. And you know what? At this point, stop taking my word for it. Just listen. Listen to the episode. Without any further ado, here she is, Sonia Pemberton, all the way from Australia. Well, Sonia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Cara. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. I'm so thrilled that we're finally able to reconnect after so long. I think I've met you twice in person, although we've talked online otherwise, but I met you once in Australia at a conference, and I met you once here in the States when you were finishing up the recording on Vitamania.
That's right. Yes, at Derek Moller's place. Filming, you got your starring moment in our film.
Yes, it was quite an intimate little lunch we had with, you know, Derek and the kids and Raquel and the friends and, you know, just a camera person and a producer, like you always do at lunch.
That was a really fun day, and it was wonderful to actually be able to finish the film in that way, because we traveled a 2-year journey with it, Derek and I, and to finish at his house with his friends and family, actually eating a meal and traveling the full journey with Vitamins and Vitamania, it was kind of fitting that it ended there. So that was lovely.
Absolutely. So we'll get back into Vitamania soon for people who are listening who are like, oh, I love that movie. And other people who are listening who are like, what the hell is Vitamania? We'll come back to that. But maybe I'd love to start by just talking to you a little bit about the work that you've been doing in, you know, kind of science-focused documentary-style filmmaking. You know, how long have you been actually focused specifically on these kinds of science stories?
Well, it's coming up to 20-odd years, I think. I mean, I trained originally in medicine and didn't complete my medical degree because I got sidetracked into journalism and filmmaking. But I always had a passion for science. My family are all medical, and my grandfather's quite a famous medical researcher. And so I was kind of brought up always thinking about medicine, science, biology, and the line around our family dinner table was always justify your position, which meant what are your sources? So I always grew up, whether in Northern Ireland where I was born or later in Australia, always very conscious of trying to explore things in a way, but making sure you had the facts to back them up. And so it actually was quite a natural evolution for me to move into science journalism and then science filmmaking. I mean, at least it seems natural looking back. At the time, it felt very weird. But I went to film school and ended up doing film for years. And then I got bored. I was working on great big dramas where I met my husband, who's a drama cinematographer. And my agent came to me one day and said, I know you're a bit bored. There's a science series over here with CSIRO and the World Health Organization. Do you fancy applying? And I did. And all of a sudden, my two worlds collided. My passion for science and information and references and kind of understanding stuff with my real love of making films. And so it all came together about 20 years ago, really. And I've been focused purely on science filmmaking for the best part of the last 10 years.
That's incredible. And when did you form your production company that you are currently the creative director of, Gene Pool Productions?
Gene Pool is 8 years old this year, which is fabulous. We've made quite a lot of science films in those 8 years. I forget how many hours we're getting up to now. It must be about 12 or something. And we make the high-level science documentaries, you know, $1 million an hour and up kind of global films. And we've made a few of the faster turnaround smaller things. But all up, I've now made 70 hours of documentary, of which probably 55 hours are science. So that's quite a lot to have made, I realize now, looking back. But the passion for focusing on science and creating Australia's only science-focused independent television company, that started about 8 years ago. And we're very fortunate because we work with all the global broadcasters and a lot of the big institutions. And I have a lot of kind of really great people I can just call to do my research. And my husband likes to joke, you know, that the Nobel laureates in my phone book are very handy from time to time. And it's true. It's like, you know, when you've proven your stripes a bit, that you're focused on science and you really care about the science, people learn to trust you. And I often say that I'm a science communicator first and a filmmaker second, which is counterintuitive in the kind of zeitgeist where supposedly being a filmmaker is the thing you're supposed to aspire to, according to some people. But I'm very clear on the distinction. If I have to, and I often do have to, make a judgment call that says, am I going to value getting the science right and doing responsible science journalism over making a really fascinating or controversial or demanding piece of telly, I'm always looking for the hybrid. But if I'm forced to choose, I will always come up with the science has to drive the story. And it's proven to be a good move because we've kind of gained that credibility and respect that allows us to do films at all sorts of levels with all sorts of people around the world. And I consider myself so bloody lucky, you know. It's an extraordinary privilege. And these days with, you know, the internet and so forth, being able to release our films online has been really interesting. Often we're constricted by our broadcaster relationships, but I love the fact that the paradigm of how you create science for mass media is utterly changed in the last decade. I just love what you see on YouTube, the podcasts, the vodcasts, all these sorts of things where you see science everywhere. I think the more we have, the better. Mm-hmm. And I don't make a distinction, actually. I just happen to do long form with pictures that has to generate a lot of money to get made. So therefore, it has to fulfill a lot of objectives. But basically, we're all in the same game of trying to get good science out there.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, your films have obviously garnered a ton of awards. Like you're getting not just viewership, right? People watch them and they love them, but critical acclaim, which must be some, you know, really positive feedback when sometimes these labors of love can really run a year, 2 years, 3 years in the making. I'd love to ask you about a few of these because I'm looking through, you know, some of the accolades. Like obviously you've won an Emmy Award, or have you won more than one Emmy Award?
I'm aiming for a few more.
That's amazing. And you've won Jackson Hole Science Media Awards, which I know quite well, you know, some National Press Club Awards. But I'm also seeing Eureka Awards, which appear to be just an incredible honor. But I had not heard of them before, because I think this is an Australian award, right?
That's right. So they call them our Emmys of Science. The Eureka are the highest science communication awards, and not just science communication, because it's also scientists get Eureka Awards. So it's judged by the scientific community in Australia. And one of, I think it's 15 awards, is for science journalism. The others are for the actual people doing the real science and the people who teach the science. And they're valuable awards. They come with a good prize money, and they are considered the top award in our country. And what I like about them is they're given by scientists, not by other filmmakers. Mm-hmm. So it's really lovely to win the filmmaking awards, and they matter a great deal. But to win the awards given by the science community is fantastic. And we've won 5, which is a record, I believe.
Wow.
And so in our world here, if I say I've won 5 Eureka Prizes for science journalism, the doors just open. What it means is check your facts. It means that you've consulted sensibly, that even if you've taken a perhaps a controversial angle or have a controversial title, which I do a lot, they trust you and go, okay, she knows how to handle and balance the science. And so for me, it's become a calling card to get into the science institutions and to talk to the scientists that I need to talk to.
And of course, that raises a question for me, really, about the landscape of science media, you know, because it's not just science journalism. It really is, in many ways, this kind of edutainment, this term that we use for something that's both, you know, jam-packed with information and, like you said, well-researched and evidence-based, but also is fundamentally entertaining. Otherwise, people just, they wouldn't watch it. And, you know, the work that you do, much of it airs in Australian television or in Australian media, but there's a lot of crossover. You know, many of these things have American partners that are their broadcast partners here. And I'm just wondering what your take is on the difference between the American and the Australian media landscape, and what some of the difficulties you run into are when you're broadcasting something in different markets.
That's a very good question. Look, we do always make global films. I cannot fund the films I make if I'm trying to sell into Australia. So it's absolutely imperative that we have the international partners. And usually I have one European partner, sometimes one Asian partner, one American partner, and Australia. And that's the best way to kind of put it together. The sensibilities for all of those different territories are quite different. Mm-hmm. I've been very fortunate, except for 2 projects, I've managed to make one film work for all markets, and that's unusual, but I've had a lot of success doing that out of the 70-odd films we've done. An example is a film we did called Jabbed, Love, Fear and Vaccines about 4 years ago. We made the international version, a 90-minute film, and we filmed in Bhutan. We followed the measles outbreak across France and Britain. We filmed, I think it was 9 countries all up, and it had a very deliberately global feel, like all our films do, with a couple of core Australian stories to make sure we fulfill our local needs as well. Now, when that was, we looked with our American partners, there was a decision to remake that for Nova, PBS Nova, to turn that into a very different kind of film. And Vaccines Calling the Shots is the Nova version. Now, fundamentally, they're the same film. They're the film about vaccine hesitancy and why people choose not to vaccinate or hesitate to vaccinate or just delay vaccination, and trying to work out what's going on and not just blame and point fingers and shout at people and say you're just nuts. I actually explore this and go deeper. So we worked with London epidemiologists who are mapping vaccine concerns globally. We went to the high country in Bhutan to see how Bhutan came to a different decision to India next door. We had this really big global perspective, but it was decided that for the American audience, the Americans wouldn't be interested in the rest.
Oh, gosh.
And so the film was very much targeted to an American audience. For example, in Australia and most of Asia, autism is not a concern that the vaccine hesitants bring up. Mm. It's just not the correlation in their minds is very it's weak. There were far more higher ranking worries people have in Australia and parts of Asia. But in America, it's in the top five concerns that parents had. So it was really important that the American version of the film really went into this fear of vaccines being related to autism. Now, although we know the science is clear, that is not the case. People still have those concerns. The international version, we were very clear on saying, look, it's okay to be afraid of these vaccines. It's okay. It's completely understandable. You're putting some foreign object into your child's body. I understand your fear, but being stopped by the fear is not enough. The fear is the starting point for asking some really good questions. And when you ask the questions and you get the answers that are backed by really good evidence, you'll come to this conclusion that vaccines are the very best option we've got right now to deal with these horrible diseases. For the American version, there was a lot of hesitancy around using the term, it's okay to be afraid. Now, we ended up in the film, but it was felt like that was given too much leeway, too much latitude to people's fears. So there's very interesting cultural sensitivities I have to adapt to. So that's an example where we made two different versions of the same film because the sensitivities and the sensibilities were quite different. With Vitamania, we made a different version for Europe, for France and Germany, and then another version for the rest of the world. Because in Europe, the approach to vitamins and taking of vitamins is different in some key ways. And they wanted us to go into more depth about why they're different. That's not totally appropriate to the rest of the world. So we had two different versions there. But for the most part, I really attempt to make versions that are globally relevant to everyone. Because really, every film I'm interested in making is fundamentally about an epic story of our time. And I only take on stories of polarization. They're the ones that interest me. You know, I'm interested in the big stories where people disagree. So we have climate change, we have vaccines, we have uranium twisting the dragon's tail, we have vitamins. Right now we're doing GMOs and genetic engineering. And we have another one about facts. So, you know, I'm very interested in spending my time and the time of my company on investigating and investing time and resources into trying to figure out how can we contribute to the conversations out there. From my point of view, there's absolutely no point in me making a film that just adds to the clutter. You know, absolutely no point. Like, for example, you'd say, hang on, there's so many films about vitamins. And I'd go, yep, there certainly are. But what I went looking for was, there are lots of films that were pro-vitamins and there are lots of films that are anti-vitamins. And the more science-informed or science-literate you were, the more likely you were to say, oh, look, you know, you're just getting expensive urine. And the other extreme, of course, of people who think they can solve all sorts of problems that they've got nothing to do with. But I couldn't find any films that went in the middle and just explored it. What's the history of vitamins? How do we discover them? What are these molecules? How do they work? What's the chemistry behind them? What's the thinking behind them? Which ones do we need? Why do we need them? What happens when you turn them into the pills? How do you turn them into pills? What are those pills made of? Who's regulating those pills? You know, I wanted to ask a whole set of questions that I couldn't find the answers to easily out there. And I also wanted to bring a scientific sensibility to it so that we only go where the evidence takes us. But at the same time, we explore some of the nonsense. That's why we called it The Sense and Nonsense. But I'm deeply interested in these issues about polarizing science where there's conflict and disagreement, because that's where I think perhaps a film can have some use.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I'm so interested in your films. I mean, I think that oftentimes, you know, I'll be spending time with my friends and we'll talk about new science programming and they'll say, you know, did you watch this new series or did you see this documentary? And the response quite often is like, yeah, it's not really for me. And I think that this is a struggle that people who are really, I don't know if, I don't want to use the word entrenched, because I don't think that's appropriate, but people who spend a lot of their time reading science articles and sharing science stories and, you know, who work as science communicators, like myself, like you, sometimes when we watch science programming, it's kind of lost on us, like we're not the right audience for it. But I do love a good documentary that explores the human relationship with science and culture and how those things intersect, as well as sort of the controversy that exists. And I love a documentary that fairly gets into the minds of the individuals who are struggling with that controversy and doesn't just denigrate them or put them down. Sometimes I think that's the easy kind of cheap way out. And in the scientific skeptical community, which I am a proud part of, I think we far too often lean on the, oh, well, those people are stupid, or those people just don't understand, they're ignorant, we just need to give them more information. But the truth is, there's so many reasons that people take vitamins, and sometimes good reasons. There's so many reasons that people don't vaccinate their children, you know, and, you know, most of those aren't good reasons, but sometimes they are. And exploring that, I think, is important.
Yeah, and I do think one of the key things for me is, how do we cross the divide? You know, if we're truly committed to communicating science, our job is to cross the divide and to speak to the people who don't agree with us. We cannot throw up our hands and just walk away in disgust. Personally, I just can't do that. It's a waste of taxpayers' money that goes into my films, and it's a waste of time and energy if I just dismiss really what's often 60, 70, 80% of the population because they don't seem to be quite with it. I think that's patronizing and rude and dangerous, and I think obviously all around the world we're seeing the results of that. So increasing polarization and tribal identities worries me deeply. And about 5 years ago, when I was researching JABBED, I spent a year in research, and I came across the work of a marvelous man that many of your listeners may know, but Professor Dan Kahan at Yale. And he runs a thing called the Cultural Cognition Project. And it's a fantastic place to go visit if you're interested in the science of science communication. They actually measure and test empirically the science of science communication. What messages are working and why, how they work. They test all these theories. And for the first, whilst I was making JABBED, I couldn't get through to him. He's in such demand, and he writes for everything from, you know, Vox and New York Times, and he's been interviewed by everyone, that he's hard to get through. But I read deeply and listened deeply and spoke to his other kind of people around the world who do similar kinds of work, and really got a handle on how hard it is to cross the science and non-science divide. And as you said, you know, more information is not better. Shouting at people, ridiculing them does not work. I mean, who likes anyone who thinks they're stupid? Nobody. But there are some very good tools that do help. And I started to work on them in JABBED, and then we started to perfect them, I think, or perfect them. That's a terrible phrase, isn't it? But to really kind of master skills in uranium, and then in Vitamania, I really went for it. We play around with all sorts of modalities, if you like. And now on this latest project, we're sort of putting it to the test on a global scale to see what types of science communication really do help people understand complex and controversial science subjects. So I have now devoted over 5, probably 6 years of my life now to exploring this issue of how to cross the divide. Don't have all the answers, but I definitely have some tools in my toolkit.
It's not an easy one, you know, and I know that tools do exist, and I know that there is a burgeoning but also very rich literature, you know, like actual peer-reviewed literature out there about the science of science communication. And I know that we're getting a bit meta and wonky when we talk about that on this show, but it's so near and dear to my heart as it is to yours. But we don't often heed the advice. It's so wonderful to hear that you are really digging deep and trying to understand those tools and actually utilize them, because as easy as it is to say that it's not a knowledge deficit problem and just just giving more information doesn't solve the problem. We often default back to that, to just, well, let me just explain it one more time and maybe you'll get it this time. And it's just not that effective.
Yeah, I can give you an example if you like.
I'd love it.
So take the film Jabbed, Love, Fear, and Vaccines. We had a story in our film. We have six stories, personal stories, three of very serious complications, including death, fairly major complication that result from not having a vaccine. And controversially, we had three cases of genuine bad vaccine reactions. Now, it took me years to find these and be able to verify them, one of which was a young boy who had catastrophic brain damage, 18 hours after his first vaccine at the age of 6 months. One of those archetypal stories you see on the internet about one child 20 hours later, you know, is having seizures and so on and so forth and goes on to have catastrophic brain damage. I was able to find one of these stories where there is really good evidence to suggest that this child's reaction was connected to the vaccine. And we were telling that story and various people said, you can't tell that story. You'll make things worse. You will make parents who weren't fearful, you'll now make them fearful. And then some people even said to me, you'll cause deaths. It was really heavy.
Wow. And those are people who you probably considered to be kind of quote unquote on your team, people who wanted to enlighten people about vaccine denial.
These were very high-ranking people. In fact, we walked out of one government meeting feeling like, they were basically telling us, do not do this, do not proceed. So it was with real caution I went into this story. Now, it turns out that that this little boy who has a serious reaction after his vaccine and goes on to have permanent lifelong brain damage, he has a condition called Dravet syndrome. He has a form of epilepsy. And this type of epilepsy, Dravet, is very serious and irreversible. And it's triggered by your first fever. Now, for most kids, it happens in the first year of life. You get your first seizure, and it's triggered by teething, getting a bad cold or the flu, or it can be triggered by your first vaccines, because vaccines sometimes cause your temperature to rise ever so slightly. And this is the case in this little boy. Now, when I was making the film, I originally spaced out his story into three acts across the scope of the film. So act one was the parents' incredible, horrible, terrifying story of their child having the seizures. They had some video, we told the heartbreaking story of your child having this terrible reaction after a vaccine. And the parents, understandably, became extremely fearful of the vaccines. Part two in the story was they discovered the scientist who just happened to be in the same city, which is lovely and ironic, who had worked out the connection between a particular gene called the SCN1A gene and its relationship to Dravet. And realizes if they test this little boy, they can find out whether he has this underlying condition. They test him and find out he does have this gene mutation. Sorry, it's not just a gene, it's a mutation in that gene. And therefore he has Dravet syndrome. And so they come to realize that the vaccine was a trigger, not a cause. And this is a deep and, as you would well appreciate, fundamental issue about understanding science. Correlation isn't causation, et cetera, et cetera. But the vaccine is connected as a trigger in this instance, not in every instance of Dravet, but in some. Now, this was a very powerful, very emotional story. And when I had it in three blocks, it dominated the film and it was a cliffhanger. Each act was a cliffhanger. And then one of our wonderful immunization advisors said, Sonia, please don't space out those three stories over the one episode, because somebody may not get to the end and never learn that this is a trigger, not a cause. You need to keep these three blocks in your story together. And I did. I recut the film and we put the three blocks together. It's less powerful as a piece of television, as a piece of theatre, if you like, but it's very true to communicating effective science. And the other thing we noticed was if we use the term herd immunity in the film, testing, our audience testing on vaccine hesitant groups, and we did a lot of testing, they would switch off. We had cameras on them and we could just watch it. There's a ripple across the room. They would just turn away. They'd start talking amongst themselves. And then we did questionnaires and had conversations after the screening saying, what happened to you at 12 minutes, 55 seconds? You know, there's this point in the film where you all turned to each other and just basically rejected the film. We also found on comprehension tests, their comprehension of the next 5 minutes absolutely plummeted, vanished. They said, oh, it's that bloody term herd immunity. God, that's just what people use when la, 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 that's the scientific la, 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 la.
So it's a buzzword to them.
Buzzword. So yeah. Very simple thing is we took the term herd immunity out. We left the concept. We left the animations. We left all the conversations, but we never used the phrase herd immunity. And then we ran the testing on different groups of people, and that glitch in comprehension, that glitch in attention did not happen.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now,
one of the reviews I got from a scientific magazine that actually covered our film, their one criticism of the film is Sonia Pemberton's film is very good and la, 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 la. However, she neglects to actually mention the idea of herd immunity. And I thought, isn't this ironic? I wish this journalist had called me and asked me why.
And also, you did mention it.
Yeah,
you just didn't use the word.
The word. And it would have been a much more interesting article that journalist would have written had they come back and said, look, it's really odd. You know, you demonstrate the concept, but you never use the term. What on earth's going on? But that's a classic example of the science of science communication. My objective was to speak to the people who were vaccine hesitant, not the vaccine refusers, the vaccine hesitant. I wasn't speaking to the vaccine refusers because all of the data show that you actually probably can't make a difference there.
Yeah.
People who are on the fence, people who are thinking, and that's the majority of people who have fears around vaccines. The actual numbers of people who actually refuse vaccines in our country is less than 1.5%. In America,
wow.
At the time of the film, it was about 3%. It's very small. But the group that are worried and what we put into this group that you could call a vaccine hesitant, depending on how you measure that, are between 12 and 35%. And if you look at the under 40-year-olds with 1 degree or more, the level of vaccine hesitancy goes up dramatically. So it might be interesting for your audience because I would imagine you have a younger audience and often with quite good tertiary qualifications. So they might be seeing this as well. And what the data show, if you want to actually communicate to this group, you have to take away the buzzwords. You have to take away the kind of knee-jerk reaction of making them feel or sound or look a bit foolish and actually acknowledge where these fears come from, that some of them are grounded in like a kernel of truth sometimes. Like so many things in the world, you know, there's a kernel of truth underneath the rumor and under the whisper and under the fear. And then unpack that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end, you know, what the international version clearly says of Jabbed, it says, this may not be a perfect answer to how we deal with these diseases, but it's the best option we've got right now. You know, and we only have vaccines for diseases for which we have no cures. And people forget this. They seem to think that, you know, we can just go and get some antibiotics or something later. And they don't understand the reason why people are still dying, even in very wealthy countries with great medical systems, is that once they get one of these diseases and they're unlucky enough to have a severe reaction, which, of course, is a minority, but it happens, there's not much we can do. And that's a shock to a lot of people because they somehow think modern medicine can fix it all. So getting to that point without hammering them over their head with the more and more information and holding them by the hand, in a sense, and taking them through stories and acknowledging their fears and speaking to their curiosity.
Yeah.
To me, they're the things that make a difference, you know.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's program, starting with Calm. I am so excited to be partnering with Calm. They're the number one app to help you sleep, meditate, and relax. You've probably heard me say a lot lately that meditation has become kind of a part of my standard practice, or at least mindfulness. I don't really meditate all the time. I try to take out 10, 15 minutes a day to do that, but it's more about being mindful in everything I do, from walking to eating, and to taking some quiet time for myself. I love Calm because it really helps you, whether you've been meditating for a long time or you're just getting started. You're sort of scared of what secrets might be unlocked in your own mind. You have no idea what to do. That's a pretty common concern. You don't have to worry about that at all with Calm, because there are programs that are like 7-day programs for people who are just starting. There are daily Calm programs. There are programs for sleep. There are programs for anxiety, for eating, for stress, for college students even. Gosh, there's just so many options. It would take you forever, like actually forever, to get through everything in the app, because there's a new daily Calm every single day. I think that this has been huge for my mental health. It also helps me sleep at night because there's a series of music underneath the music banner, and you can play everything from focus music while I'm reading and doing schoolwork. I usually play that in my noise canceling headphones, all the way to sleep music to help me sleep at night. Guys, there's so many options for you. You've just got to go to calm.com/nerdy and you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription. I have one. I actually bought like a lifetime subscription because I'm that much of a fan. So again, that's C-A-L-M, calm.com/nerdy, where you'll get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today. And if you want to sign up, 25% off a Calm premium subscription. Calm.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Twillery for their support of the show. Oh my gosh, I love Twillery. I got a bunch of shirts for different guys in my life. And I'll tell you what, like I was a little bit skeptical at first, like I think a lot of people are, because I was getting these shirts online and just kind of adding in some measurements. And I do have a person in my life who's very discerning and actually only gets his button-down shirts custom made, perfectly tailored to him. But I'll tell you what, his favorite is a Twillery shirt. It's crisp and white and has these really cool skulls in the lining kind of the collar. It's super punk rock and totally just for him. But the other shirts that I got, some of them were preppy for my preppier friends. Some of them were a little bit sporty. They really run the gamut of any style you can think of. They're comfortable. They're really easy to care for. They look great. And again, I was so surprised, but they fit perfectly. You can also save a whole lot when you bundle. You can get a $100 shirt for $55 when you buy in bulk. Because come on, you're going to need more than one shirt anyway. There's always free shipping in the US. There's always free returns. And you get these cool free brushed nickel collar stays with each shirt. They keep your collars looking really good. They're tailored. They're slimming. You can wear them tucked, you can wear them untucked. They have this great like no iron technology called Safe Cotton. I don't know what you're waiting for. There's like, I can't say enough good things about Twillery. So guys, as the listeners of the show, you can get $25 off your first shirt order. All you've got to do is go to twillery.com/nerdy and enter the promo code nerdy at checkout. And just to be safe so that you do this, it's T-W-I-L-L-O-R-Y, twillery.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I strongly suspect, and I would love for you to clarify this for me, that you may sometimes run up against a lot of pushback when you're talking to American partners, potential partners, you know, when you're pitching to certain studios or to certain production companies that you may need to partner with, or just organizations that are going to be handling distribution or broadcast, simply because, and I would love to know some of the differences in kind of the Australian landscape and the American landscape with regard to sort of the amount of trust in the actual audience. Your films assume that the people watching this are smart and they're going to understand the concepts that you give them. Your films do not, quote unquote, dumb things down. They deliver complicated topics in very graspable ways. But one thing that I run against working in an American media landscape is that oftentimes a great idea becomes so watered down because of fears from whether it's the, you know, television executives or the people at the production companies that the audience won't get it or they won't be interested in something that's so high level. And it's frustrating.
You really hit on a couple of really key points. That's a big question. It's a double barrel question, really. The issue of trust. I think in America, I have seen some studies that back this up. The level of trust in institutions in science, in medicine, and doctors in America is lower than it is here. For the most part, the majority of Australians have quite high trust levels of scientists and medical professionals, and the groups that represent the kind of science, like CSIRO in our country, your average punter sort of thinks of them as a friendly, nice bunch of people that are just trying to find out stuff, you know. It's great. I don't know if in America the NIH is felt of them in quite the same way, maybe. But the studies I've seen really suggest that Americans do mistrust institutions and so forth more than we do here. So that is a fundamental issue. However, you talk about the trust in the audience being smart. I aim at a smart 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Every film. I'm thinking of the intelligent, curious 17-year-olds I know, and I aim there because they're not quite at university level, and they, you know, they might know what a gene means, but not what genome means. You know, they've got an idea of vaccines, but they don't understand the immune process or how to activate immune cells. You know, so they've got a basic understanding, but I have to do science block 101, 102, 103 to prime them to understand where we're going with this film. So I assume that I'm speaking to a smart 17-year-old, and that was just a decision I made 15 years ago, because for the most part, I choose to believe that most people are not inherently foolish or stupid. You know, we have a bell curve. Sorry, some will be, but they're not going to probably turn into these kinds of films anyway. I will do a lot of work to try and make them accessible so that they're fun, in inverted commas, whatever that is, you know, whatever level of fun is relevant to that film, because, hello, a vaccines film is not relevant to be fun. But Vitamania was. We break into song, whether you like that or not, we break into song. We tried to have some fun to say, look, you know, we can enjoy the ride. In Uranium, we use an incredible mixture of iconic archive and hilarious stuff that just makes you laugh out loud. Because although the issues are quite deep, we can have some fun. So getting to the point where the audience will engage, yes, that's requires skill and kind of years of experience, I suppose. I don't expect to be reaching 100% of people. I think there's a certain skew that happens with people who come to science films. Interestingly, our films skew, traditionally science films and science programming, as you're probably well aware, will skew a little bit more male than female. But our films pretty much skew straight down the middle, with the exception of Uranium, which skewed more male, because I think that's physics and you see a slightly different shift there. And so I'm trying to give you something that is a ride, that's a kind of an adventure. We take you places you couldn't go yourself. Like, you know, we go into the seed bank in Svalbard, or we climb mountains in Bhutan, or we go to the Lofoten Islands in Vitamania, and we go to Svalbard to really have a look at the story of how vitamin D came to be. We try and take you on these journeys to places that make the ride enjoyable. And then the science comes through that, you know. And the TV execs, yes, there's caution. I choose my partners. There's caution on their side and on mine. You know, I feel very fortunate that I've got a track record and they trust me to make good and sensible and factually accurate films. But I wouldn't pitch it to a network that wanted, you know, a particular kind of approach. I've had many people ask me to make my films more aggressive, if you like, or more, like I made a film called Catching Cancer about whatever it was now, 8 years ago. And it was about infectious cancers, the idea of there's certain viruses and bacteria that can trigger cancers. And I've been working at it for 9 years before I got funded. Oh my goodness, I don't even like to think about that. And it took two of our characters, Barry Marshall and Robin Warren, winning the Nobel Prize for everyone to go, oops, maybe you've got something here. And then it took Harold Zuhausen, who won the Nobel Prize for the HPV vaccine. He won the Nobel Prize during our filming, so our film was very pertinent. And so, but I had a lot of, I had a couple of key broadcasters who wanted me to go, did you know you could catch cancer? And I'm going, I'm not doing that because yeah. I fear the bejesus out of anybody who is nursing or caring for someone with cancer. And at that point, I was actually helping care for my mother who was dying of a form of leukemia. And wow. The came out of her leukemia because she worked for the Leukemia Foundation. She was what they call a death buddy. And she would spend many, many hours of every day with people in the final stages of leukemia. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of caring for her, and I was literally holding her. I remember I was holding her in my arms and stroking her head, and she's down to 37 kilos. And, you know, I don't know what that is in pounds, sorry. tiny, you know, absolutely tiny. Yeah. I thought, my goodness, you know, dogs catch leukemia, cats catch leukemia. I wonder if humans can catch leukemia. And so began a 9-year journey of my life. but, you know, resisting the broadcasters who wanted to turn it into this terrifying story that I could have caught the cancer from my mother, because, hello, it crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go 150 years, and everybody thought you caught cancer from people that had cancer. That's why they put them in wards that were off and separate. So did I want to restart that particular fear? No. So I make decisions about the partners I go with based on their wonderful generosity in A, funding us, but also backing the vision that I've got. And having the vision of the story you want to tell, I do a lot of work before I talk to them, you know, like I nearly always do a year's worth of work before I'm funded. So I work for nothing for a year, employing people whilst I, you know, generate these projects. And they all take at least a year to do the sort of in-depth analysis that we'll do and the conversations we need to do. And then we'll partner up carefully. You know, and I'm exploring some new partnerships with some great broadcasters at the moment. And one of the things we're carefully doing is making sure that we want the same voice, to have the same voice. We want the same outcome. The outcome I'm after is to produce a useful film. Mm-hmm. There's no point in me making just a beautiful film or a clever, smart-ass film. I've got to make films that are fundamentally useful to the people they're targeted at. Because they're going to be seen by between 10 and, say, 25 million people over a period of about 10 years. On average, that's what we've worked out. Depends if we get a Chinese broadcast and an Indian broadcast, because the numbers just go up dramatically. But they also live on in schools for usually around about 10 years. And, you know, they're in thousands of schools. And so I have a responsibility to make sure that I'm telling a story that doesn't alarm people unnecessarily, that equips them with some basic background knowledge that helps them understand something and maybe a cute way of thinking about it. I mean, when we made the film called Immortal that we won the Emmy for, that was with Professor Elizabeth Blackburn, and we started filming with her 2 years before she won the Nobel Prize. And again, she was my fifth person to win a Nobel Prize. Lots of filming with them. Five people in 7 years. Can you believe that?
Wow.
I picked five of them in 7 years that won Nobel Prizes. And it became a running joke that, you know, we knew more about the process of, you know, what was going to happen to them. I used to start to advise them on how to equip themselves with extra phones and things like that just in case. it was a bizarre 5-7. But, you know, people, firstly, how do you sell a film to international broadcasters on telomerase and telomere biology? Really? How do you?
Yeah.
And she had a at that stage. And so most people just looked at me blankly. And so what did I do? I called it immortal. And Elizabeth went, oh, sorry. Immortal? Really? Really? You know? I said, look, it's about the immortal cell, not immortal life. So I'll make that distinction during the film. But at the moment, of course, that's a catchier title. But also we came up with this metaphor of the shoelaces metaphor about telomeres being the far end of the shoelace. Now, that metaphor is everywhere. That is the metaphor she uses, that the Nobel Committee use, that every little show you ever hear talking about telomeres talks about, think of them like shoelaces at the far end of, and at the time Liz was going, oh, well, are you sure we should do shoelaces? And I'm going, yeah, it's helpful. You can imagine shoelaces, you know, a pair of shoelaces, and the far end of your shoelaces, the caps of your shoelaces, are like your telomeres. And these little caps, they fray with time. You can't thread them through the eyelets of your sneakers anymore. And that's your telomeres getting shorter and shorter. And eventually the telomeres get so short or so frayed that you cannot lace up your shoelaces. It's a really simple metaphor. But what we found is it cut through. And again, if you're thinking of your smart 17-year-old, it's graspable.
Yeah.
And they don't have to get into the heavy duty defining a telomere quite yet. You can do that later once we've got the basic concept. But that was a hard pitch, you know, and I had to, my husband and I actually went off and filmed that, most of it, before we got funded, just because I was so in love with the science. I just thought the whole science of telomere biology was so gobsmackingly beautiful and so inspiring that when she won the Nobel Prize, it was really quite lovely. And then everybody wanted the film. And then I won an Emmy. And it was really funny. We won an Emmy shortly after she won the Nobel, and we both had a bit of a drink over that one and celebrated on a very good bottle of red.
I love that. You know, a theme that I feel like is emerging throughout this conversation is really one about a sort of responsibility to the public, a sort of obligation to ensure that that the representation of these different ideas is fair and it's well-researched and it's well-informed. And, you know, this kind of social responsibility takes me to another area that I'm quite interested in, which is representation of people. And of course, you know, Immortal was about Elizabeth Blackburn. She's not the only researcher, the only telomere researcher, but she's one that you chose to feature. And you yourself are a woman in a very heavily, predominantly male industry, you know, directing documentary films. I myself on Talk Nerdy, I try to make sure that at least 50% of the women that I interview on the podcast, or 50% of the people that I interview on the podcast are women, at least. Yet, I still have an 80% male listenership, and I struggle with that quite a bit, which I think is just really, like you talked about earlier, kind of tied into the subject matter. But I would love to hear some of your sort of, I don't know, your takes, your perspectives on working in this industry, making sure that representation is something that you care about, and whether or not you've really had to push against some limits or some difficulties.
Well, I'm very proud to say that vaccines calling the shots on Nova, 2 years ago now, was the first Nova ever narrated by an African-American woman.
Wow.
Now, that was interesting. Firstly, they have very few. I'm not sure if it was the first female ever, but they very rarely have Novas that have a female voiceover.
Oh,
but
for sure.
I didn't even know the narrator was African-American until we started talking. And it was just really interesting going, that mattered to me. That was really great. It turns out she had a science degree. Even though she was an actor and a voiceover artist, she loved science, and so she so got into it. But, yes, it's important to me. I mean, I'm attracted to stories of I mean, the classic paradigm shifts, you know, we made a film about Barry Marshall and Robin Warren. That was two men, two Australian men. But when they won the Nobel Prize for showing that Helicobacter pylori caused stomach cancer. And, you know, that is a story of an underdog, if you like, overcoming the paradigm of the time and all. That's a lovely story to get to tell. Often the female scientists have a little bit of that, you know, they're often fighting things themselves. So this is extra the hurdles to cross. But for me, I love focusing on female characters as much as I can. And to be honest, I do make an effort. I mean, Elizabeth was the person I wanted to follow because she was an Australian scientist doing amazing work. That's why it became the film about Elizabeth. And of course, Carol Greider and the teams, the wider teams all involved were all part of that. But yes, I wanted to focus on her. I try as much as I can to have different kinds of representation. Age really matters to me. I'm very sick of elderly white men in science documentaries. I'm very sorry to any of these elderly white men who are listening. But, you know, I think that's a very important part to play, but they shouldn't dominate the narrative. And when you look at the YouTubers and people like you doing the work you're doing and Derek's work he's doing and Elise, Andrew's doing what she's doing with IFLS, you're all young people doing this work. You know, and this is so important that we reflect what younger generation are doing in science, as well as the wiser, older, more experienced people who've got this wealth of knowledge. So that kind of representation matters. Trying to get ethnic diversity is hard in a lot of science films, but we
really is. I struggle with it as well on the podcast, and that's really because of the historical, you know, institutional barriers that individuals have faced. So, if science itself is not, you know, is not friendly to people of color, then it's very difficult to show people of color without going to the same people over and over, and you know, fighting against that tokenism, which is such a disgusting thing that ends up happening.
That's right. And I have to stop myself going, oh, stop trying to be PC here. You can't, you know, you've got to tell the science the best way you possibly can tell the science. But, you know, the other thing is for us, because it's also film, you know, you're seeing people. So you'll see visually we represent a lot of different. But that's why in Jabbed, we went to Bhutan, we went to Germany, we had people in India, we had a big Indian section. You know, I film in China whenever I can, I film in Japan whenever I can. The biggest bias, and I'm going to ruffle a few feathers with this one, but the biggest bias in America is pro-American. I can't tell you how many times I've heard Americans claim that the Americans discovered X, Y, or Z. When you go, hang on, no, they're part of a research group and the actual person who did the first thing was this person and the person who did the second thing was this person and your team came in and did that bit. And you go, I'm sorry. I mean, every country has its kind of national pride around these things, but, you know, sometimes I find I have to remind our American partners that, no, that's not actually true, you know. It is very true in some cases, but not in all. And sure that the films aren't totally saying America's dominating all of the science in the world, that's a really big issue because there's great scientists in Japan, in China, in India, in Australia, in the UK. You know, they're all over the world. America has a massive advantage in terms of funding often and a wonderful skill set and wonderful universities. So there's a lot of things going on. But to only base your stories in America, I think, is a mistake. And also, I'd love to know from your audience or your experience, but this thing that they keep telling me is American audiences are only interested in American stories or American characters. Is that true?
You know, I mean, it's so difficult. I think what it really comes down to is the fact that, you know, this American quote-unquote exceptionalism, like you said, many countries have a nationalistic bent, which is terrible, but it's part of, I think, being able to recruit for the military. It's part of, you know, the narrative that has been in place since, you know, the countries had a national identity. But I think the problem in America really fundamentally comes down to the fact that we have an isolation media. You know, we are very rarely exposed to world news. And it really does develop a sensibility that as a nation, we can be insular and we can see only American people doing American things, and that these American things are the things that make the world go round. And it doesn't help when we have representation in government, like when our own president is like the worst version of an American exceptionalist. He's actually a white nationalist and literally believes that, like, not just Americans are better, but like white male Americans are better. And that's hugely problematic for individuals to develop, you know, that kind of sensibility. And one of the bummer things too is that American people are ethnically diverse. I mean, that's a great part about being American. Yet somehow people don't see the ethnic diversity as being fundamentally American, which is bizarre to me.
Yeah. When I spend at least 2 or 3 months a year in various parts of the state, and I love it. And I love being there. I've got family there. I really enjoy my time. And I look around and I go on the streets. Mm-hmm. In most parts of America, not all, of course, but you see every color of the rainbow.
Oh, yeah.
Much more on the streets of Sydney or Melbourne. And I love that. And I kind of question why it's so hard to just include a sequence in Bhutan in a film.
It's so strange. I mean,
when I've anecdotally kind of screened versions of the film, the number of people that say to me, oh, I would have loved to have seen that because I've never seen what it's like for school in India or Bhutan being vaccinated. Or I've never seen how people in the far north of Norway get their vitamin D. It's just like I love all that. Maybe it's because I was brought up in multiple countries and I just have this sense of the world as a big, beautiful place and there's so much big, beautiful science going on. And the further we progress in many of these areas of science, the more interconnected we all are and interdependent we all are. And these epic stories of our times, the biggest stories of our times, are science-based. You know, whether it's climate change, whether it's AI, whether it's genetics and genetic engineering, we've got some of the biggest stories that are science-based, and they're global stories.
Absolutely. And I think that as much as, there are powers that be, forces that be, that want to maintain this isolationism, the good news is that the times, they are a changin'. And that's really because of, the internet. It's because of people like you mentioned, like Derek is a great example. He's a multinational person. You know, he was born in Canada. He attended university. He was born in Australia. Okay. He attended university. He's born in Australia, attended university in Canada, also came to the U.S. His parents are South African. He is multicultural in that way. Raquel, his partner, is Portuguese. And I think he brings some of those perspectives. And of course, there's so many more people like him. But he's also making his own programming on his own channel, where there aren't those institutional barriers that we often think of when we think of, higher budget broadcasts. You rely on funding in order to make these big, beautiful films. And because of that, you sometimes have to work with people who are highly disconnected from the actual people who are going to be watching the films. And that is, I think, where one of the big problems lies, is that the people who have the institutional control, who have the purse strings, aren't always representing their viewers. At least not well. And I think there are plenty of viewers who want to see a multinational perspective. But the people that are, in control of what airs on their networks are afraid of that.
Yeah. Some. Not all.
True.
I mean, I partner up often usually with public broadcasters like PBS and other, which I think are very good. And, I think, PBS, Arte, ZDF, RSBS, ABC, the BBC, all of these groups, NHK in Japan, there are really good broadcasters that have the public remit as their brief. And yes, they might get a bit disconnected in ivory towers, like every single profession does, but I think they have an awareness of trying to fulfill multiple needs.
And they're beholden to their audience. They're not beholden to advertisers, which really does help.
And you've got Netflix now, of course, and the other SVODs. and groups, and you know, they're also working out what their role is in delivering some of them science to that audience, and who's going to come to that. And I think that's great. You know, the more, the merrier, and the more formats we have. You know, at the moment, I'm always restricted. I have to do 55 minutes or a 90-minute or 2 or 3 hour, you know, and they have to be down to the minute. And for some of the broadcasts, they have to be down to the frame. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, wow, you know, so that doesn't allow you to necessarily let a story run the length it would naturally run, which is usually shorter. Yeah, 'cause, you know, sometimes I'd love to just do a 40-minute piece, but there isn't a market for that. So, but that's the game I've chosen to play. You know, I've chosen, and television is a shifting, changing media landscape, and it's morphing into the whole online media landscape. And I think that's a bloody good thing. You know, I'm so excited by it, and I love the stretching of the boundaries of what we call film and what we call television and what we call media. And I think for all of us who love communicating ideas around science, that's a great thing. Whether you do it as an alternate reality piece or a VR piece or a short video. I mean, look at the guys, you know, ASAP I mean, all those fantastic guys that do their short form videos on science ideas, and Smarter by the Day and OK Designs, all these great, 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 mostly younger people doing really interesting things at a format that works for them. And I think that gives me great hope. Great, great hope.
Oh, me as well. Well, you know what? On this note, I think it's a great time to kind of move things into the direction that we often do at the end of each episode of Talk Nerdy, where I ask my guests the same two closing questions. And I'm definitely interested in your take on these questions. They're sort of big picture. So are you ready for that?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
All right. So when you look to the future in whatever context is relevant to you, you know, right now in your work and your life and your love and all of those things, number one, I want to know for you personally, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing that you maybe even have like a touch of cynicism about that you're just not really, you're not really feeling good about. And then on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, you know, personally very optimistic about?
Oh, great questions. Really beautiful. Well, what keeps me up at night, other than just whatever project I'm working on, I think fundamentally it's my fear, beyond concern, my fear on the polarization around science. I have sleepless nights and I read copious amounts about this stuff and the science denialism, the growth of science, the crap that's out there. I'm sorry, I'm Australian, I swear.
I love it.
You know, sorry, it just comes with the territory.
I'm with you.
And so I lie awake at night going, what can I do to help? How can I even a tiny bit help loosen the ties of polarization or weaken the things that make pseudoscience so attractive? I feel hopeless about it at times. When I look at Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow and her websites and so forth, I can laugh and I can shudder, and some part of me goes, oh, I just don't even engage with that rubbish. Mm. But deep down I watch, and I am a great fan of Twitter. I spend a lot of time just listening on Twitter. And I watch and I listen to what's going on around pseudoscience, and that worries me profoundly and at times makes me feel hopeless.
Yeah.
In my darkest hour, I feel like what I do is a waste of time. Mm-hmm. Let's be very honest, you know, I have moments when I go, why do I bother working sometimes 20 hours a day for months? And that sounds like an exaggeration, but the people who know me will tell you it's not. I get obsessed about trying to communicate something, and my darkest moments I go, is anybody listening really?
Yeah.
Is there any difference? Is anyone changing anything? Is it making a little nudge? Can I even begin to compete with the reach and power of something like Goop? So that's my deepest, darkest, horriblest stuff in the middle of the night.
Understood. I mean, especially when, you know, like you said, working these, you know, 20-hour days and dedicating basically your life to deconstructing a problem and making sure that you're, you know, presenting it in a fair way, in an evidence-based way, in a nuanced way, when somebody can just rattle off a blog post that unfortunately doesn't play by the same rules. You know, that's the frustrating thing. It's like when there are no rules and they can just write a blog post about a jade egg in your vagina and they don't have to research anything and just say it like it is. And yet you see that there are people who believe it and who really, you know, follow it kind of unflinchingly. That I mean, obviously it's frustrating. It's so frustrating because it's like, if we had a level playing field, but we don't. Yeah.
But beyond the frustrating, it's deeply frightening. Mm. I guess that's what I'm actually flagging. Yeah. Frustration, everything's frustrating. If you look at it, hello, life can be frustrating at times. But the actual fear that we are going backwards, that there's a paganism that's rising up, that there's a closing of the mind, a closing of the boundaries between people, the building of the boundaries between people, and the inability to bridge that divide. You know, we're becoming so tribal.
Yes.
And just the very fact that I laugh at Goop, you know, that makes me part of a tribe.
Yeah.
I have to go, Sonia, you know, if I am trying to communicate to that community, I can't laugh at them. And to be honest, I have no time to laugh at anybody. I just worry.
Mm-hmm.
And I refuse in my work to be flippant. You know, Derek Muller and I, you know, had some differences of opinion with Vitamania because he really wanted to poke fun at things more than it. And he wanted to really be kind of, and fair enough, you know, he has a different approach.
Yeah.
But I had to say, look, Derek, the journey I'm on with the films I'm creating and the journey you're on with me because you're part of this is to cross the divide. And if we just make people feel stupid from the get-go, we're not going to cross the divide. And bless him, you know, he said, okay, I get it. And at times he struggled with that. The film allowed more cross-dialogue than he felt comfortable with. Now, that's something you could ask him about, but it came from this very deep commitment that I've got, is that my job, for better or worse, is to try and help cross the divide in any small way I can, because that's the thing that keeps me awake at night.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And of course, this drives your work in many ways. But obviously, there is a flip side to that as well. And it's that there's something out there that's inspiring to you and that you remain optimistic about.
Oh, yes. And the thing that gives me hope and inspires me and lights me up every day is seeing people's curiosity. The curiosity people have, no matter what side of politics they're on, no matter what tribal groupings they may or may not align with, they're curious. They are. We're all kind of kids. We're all children in some ways. There's this natural curiosity. And I see it in some of the most hardline people I've ever dealt with, who have views that are very different to mine. If I dig deeper, I see the curiosity, the wanting to understand how things work. And the fact that there are so many people out there expressing their curiosity, exploring their curiosity, clever people like you and Derek and others who are actually using the media to explore different types of curiosity. Honestly, that just makes my day. It just makes me go, the world cannot be stuffed if curiosity exists and there are a lot of clever people trying to fulfill that curiosity. Then there's hope for the planet, there's hope for us, and there's hope for the ideas becoming more interesting, more profound, and more complex. So that's what gives me hope and keeps me getting up with a smile on my face most days.
Absolutely. I think everybody listening can feel that, can understand that as well. Well, gosh, Sonia, this has been such a joy. It's been such an honor to be able to steal an hour of your life, your very busy life, for myself and for the listeners. Guys, you've got to check out Vitamania, Uranium, Jabbed, Immortal, Catching Cancer, so many incredible programs. And of course, you mentioned as well that you're working on one about genetic engineering, also one about facts. I'm so excited to see these when they finally come out. Sonia, thank you so much for joining me. It's just been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Cara. It's been a joy.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy. We'll be right back.